From KLCC Studios, this is Oregon on the Record.
I'm Michael Dunn. We've done several shows about the Cascadia Subduction Zone, the major seismic fault that could lead to a massive earthquake and tsunami in our region. Since the publication of a very scary and provocative New Yorker article years ago about Cascadia, much of the Pacific Northwest and even the world has focused on this dangerous potential. Well, a new study based on decades of hypothesis and research suggests it could be much, much worse. Today on the show, we talked to an Oregon State University professor who led a study that shows a real link between Cascadia and the famous and destructive fault to our south, the San Andreas. The study shows the potential that seismic activity on one fault could influence the other, including a massive co-joined quake that could devastate the entire West Coast. That's next on Oregon on the Record. The San Andreas Fault is so famous, Hollywood made a movie about it starring Dwayne The Rock Johnson. And of course, here in Oregon, we have our own famous fault, the Cascadia Subduction Zone. Today on the show, you'll hear from an OSU professor who's authored a study which suggests these two faults could influence each other, and were that to happen on a massive scale, the results could be a blockbuster earthquake even Hollywood couldn't imagine. Professor Chris Goldfinger, a marine and earthquake geologist with Oregon State University, thanks for coming on and talking to us.
Thanks, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Interesting study you've been a part of. I think if those of us in the Pacific Northwest were worried about one fault, the Cascadia Subduction Zone, you've given us potentially something else to worry about. Talk about what your study found.
Well, this has been a long-term project that really started almost by accident in 1999, where we were off southern Cascadia taking some cores, and we made a little navigational error, and we wound up off the northern San Andreas Fault, which is just next door to the south. We took a core there and hoping it might, you know, lead to working on the San Andreas at some time in the future. And like most people, we, you know, treated the faults as separate entities that don't interact. And so we worked on those for a number of years and wrote a couple of early papers on it. And then somewhere in the early 2000s, we started to notice that the radiocarbon ages of Cascadia earthquakes were very similar to the radiocarbon ages of the northern San Andreas earthquakes. And we started head scratching and wondering what kind of sense that could make. And it wasn't terribly obvious, but then we realized that maybe one fault was actually triggering the other fault. And so one fault transferring stress to another fault is a relatively new concept, less than 30 years old in geology. And, you know, we're still learning, since plate tectonics isn't that old at this stage, we're still learning big things. And so so that idea was, floated around a bit, and we continued to work on it. And then we finally wrote a paper in 2008, which is now, you know, a long time ago, suggesting this hypothesis. And we worked with Roland Bergman at UC Berkeley, who did the modeling of how the stress would transfer from one to the other. And it turned out it was possible, but not very efficient and not all that favorable, but possible. But at that time, we had only radiocarbon ages to compare the timings with. And radiocarbon, you know, is notoriously both useful and uncertain. So a radiocarbon age of, you know, something several hundred years old might have an uncertainty range of 150 to 250 years, or sometimes even bigger. So while the most probable ages matched up pretty well, the uncertainty was large. So you couldn't, you know, the smoking gun just wasn't there. And so we wrote more proposals and went out and collected more cores and continued on, and quite a few more years went by without really, you know, with improving the data sets and improving every aspect of it, but without finding a key link to how can we test this hypothesis. But there was a thing, something that bugged us a great deal about these beds. They're called turbidites. They're submarine landslide deposits. And the thing that bugged us about them is the ones on the San Andreas and Cascadia faults that were close to each other and close to the boundary between the two faults at Cape Mendocino. They seem to be upside down. They had the sand at the top instead of the bottom where it normally belongs. And this is like, you know, imagine taking a bucket full of sand at the beach and swirling it around, and the sand should be at the bottom. But these beds had the sand at the top, and that bugged us for actually quite a few years, and left the question open. You know, what's causing this, and does it have any relationship to anything useful? And so sometime around mid 2015, 16, somewhere in that time frame, it dawned on us, and I'm not quite sure how this happened, but that we were looking at not one bed with the sand on top, but two beds, and the lower one was finer grained, and the upper one was coarser grained. That's where the sand was. And so that explained it. You know, gravity couldn't have switched signs and gone the other way during that time, so we needed some explanation that worked. And that worked. So two deposits instead of one. So that double-decker turbidite bed. And then when that idea occurred to us, then the dam broke open. Then we realized that, oh, there's the smoking gun right there. You have these beds on top of each other, and they could represent Cascadia earthquakes and San Andreas earthquakes stacked together very closely. And in the case of, say, the 1700, the well-known 1700 earthquake.
On the Cascadia subduction zone, right?
Yeah, on the Cascadia subduction zone, mm-hmm. which we know very well, and most people have heard about, that on directly on top of it seemed to be a San Andreas earthquake that happened about the same time, around 1700. And these things were stacked so closely together that you couldn't distinguish the time between them. And that's sort of the short version of how this came about.
And when you say that potentially that they're linked, does that mean that, you know, someone like myself thinks of a fault line as just that. Does that mean that the San Andreas fault line and the Cascadia subduction fault line, they intersect, or is it not as simple as that?
Well, that's a great question. So the Cascadia subduction zone ends at Cape Mendocino along another fault called the Mendocino fault.
Okay.
And the San Andreas fault comes up to, you know, in very close proximity to it. And then what physically happens is very unclear. Nobody's really sure exactly how they physically interact. And the latest studies suggest that the San Andreas may extend into the Cascadia subduction zone some distance past Eureka and up a little bit further north. And the GPS evidence of what's actually moving suggests that. But physically how that happens, nobody really knows right now. And that's a topic of debate and future research.
Okay. Let me quickly reintroduce you to the audience, talking with Professor Chris Goldfinger, a marine and earthquake geologist with Oregon State University. You mentioned the famous earthquake on Cascadia in 1700. I'm a native Californian, and I know the San Andreas Fault well. And certainly, if my memory and knowledge is correct, the San Andreas has had earthquakes on it much more recent than 1700. So I'm wondering, in some of your research, did you find, I guess famously, like the 1906 San Francisco earthquake, if my memory serves, that was a San Andreas Fault earthquake. Did you find evidence in a relatively more recent time, like 1906 versus 1700, a relationship between San Andreas and Cascadia?
Yeah, great question. I'm also a native Californian. My grandma's house in Daly City was almost right on top of the San Andreas Fault.
Oh, wow.
Fault.
Okay. Very, very good.
So I'm very interested in both, you know, for that reason as well. But yes, yeah, so when we started working on the cores from the San Andreas area, yes, the first thing we found was the 1906 earthquake. It's very, very easily identifiable. It's traceable all the way from Cape Mendocino to San Francisco in our cores. Our cores go all the way actually to Monterey Bay. So You know, in paleoseismology, of course, if you go back to a historical earthquake and you're proposing that the beds you're seeing are earthquakes, you definitely want to see historical earthquakes in the record. If you don't see them, then something's wrong.
Sure.
And so the 1906 earthquake was there. It wasn't the youngest event, though. It was overlain by 1992 and 1980 earthquakes that were actually on Cascadia, but close enough that they could deposit a bed at the northern end of the San Andreas Fault. So we have three historical earthquakes that were recorded in that region, and so that really helps us in the confidence department in terms of, you know, what are we looking at? Are we really for sure looking at earthquakes? And when we found that we had three historical events clearly in the record and datable to very tight timelines, then that lend a great deal of, confidence into what we were doing.
Okay. I'm fascinated on how you conducted this study. Talk about the way in which you get these core samples.
Oh, well, this is sort of an industrial operation. We're using a ship that's about 270 feet long and a crew of science party and ship's crew of about 50 people. And we're taking them in water depths of around 3,000 meters or so, sometimes a little bit more. And so it's an industrial operation where we're lowering this coring device to the seafloor, and then it free falls kind of like a lawn dart into the seafloor, and it collects a 4-inch diameter sample. And we pull that back up to the surface, and we slice open the liner that it comes in. And then we start doing things like CT scanning the core and collecting geophysical data from the core, photography and magnetics and density and all these sorts of things. And then these cores are assembled and worked up and correlated from place to place in much the same way the oil industry correlates their core samples when they're looking for oil. They're also working with the same type of turbidites that we are.
What are the implications from your findings in terms of as I mentioned, at the top, I think we're all very cognizant of the potential danger of the Cascadia subduction zone. What do your findings suggest about the potential, increase in veracity and power from an earthquake if these two faults are linked?
Well, I think if I can step back.
Sure.
To talk about the timing between them, because the timing's an important feature of this whole story. If they're separated in time, then they just remain separate events. But in our case, we found evidence that these are fairly close in time, and that has big implications. So radiocarbon doesn't really allow you to get close timing to within, better than 50 years, or in a lot of cases, sometimes not as good as that. And so what we use is called a relative dating technique, where we look at the timing between events to see what the separation in time is, independent of, the absolute timing that's available from, say, radiocarbon. And so what we found was, for example, in our best example, the famous 1700 Cascadia earthquake, which is known to have occurred on January 26, 1700. That bed on the Cascadia side in our samples looks like it's directly overlain by the San Andreas earthquake that happened about the same time. But that bed was apparently laid down while the Cascadia bed was still depositing. So that's telling us that the time frame is probably hours, potentially minutes, but probably hours to maybe a day or two at the very most. And so that gets us very close in time, where radiocarbon just gets us in the ballpark. And then we have two others that are similar to that. Very close timing, but absolute timing, not as well known. The 1700 event is also supported by tree ring evidence. So a group has worked on tree rings in Northern California, looking for the penultimate San Andreas earthquake, and they believe they've found it, and there's a little ambiguity, but they think that that last earthquake was either 1698 AD or 1700 AD, and we think it's the 1700 option. And so that puts us in the same year using completely independent methods. So to come back to the implications of it, of course, if they were decades apart, that would be quite different. But the potential is that these things, these earthquakes, could happen closer in time than that. And if that were to happen, and it seems to be that these timings are not, or these pairings of these events are not a rare event. They seem to be actually the majority of the case, with 1906 being an exception. So if that's the case, then you can imagine that we've talked for years and years about, you know, the quote big one in Cascadia being a major, possibly the worst disaster in North American history, to borrow a phrase from, you know, the New Yorker article a few years back. Mm-hmm. And so if that were the case, and then the San Andreas were to go in an earthquake that stretched to San Francisco in some short time frame, that would be huge, you know, and the drawdown of the resources of the country to try to respond to two events like that and not one. It's difficult to imagine. We're having a hard time just imagining one of them, let alone two. So it's a significant thing that hasn't really been considered. Emergency managers have not really considered this in any significant way. It's been discussed a few times in FEMA, and it's even in one of their documents. But I don't think it's really been taken very seriously up to now.
Okay. Again, putting on my extremely amateur earthquake scientist hat, I've always heard that small earthquakes can be good because they can alleviate pressure. Is the potential linkage between San Andreas and Cascadia, are there elements, and I think you've used the term sort of shared energy with regard to these two faults, is it possible that a small earthquake on, for example, the San Andreas fault might help alleviate some pressure on Cascadia and vice versa?
Well, I wish that were the case, but okay. It's probably not the case. So typically, if one fault has a major rupture, what it does is it relieves the local stress, but it transfers that stress to other segments of the same fault or other nearby faults. And it can transfer stress in either increasing the load on those faults, or it can actually sometimes decrease the load on those faults, just depending on the geometry. So, but relieving stress in that sense is probably not going to be the case. In the modeling that Roland Bergman did in our 2008 paper, we found that it would load parts of, you know, a Cascadia earthquake would stress parts of the San Andreas, and it would de-stress other parts of the San Andreas. But the key bit was near the very north end where the rupture might begin. And so, you know, how that actually works loops back to what we discussed about the geometry. We just don't know the geometry all that well. So modeling it is problematic. And so we're, you know, in this paper, we discuss just the stratigraphic evidence that it happened. Exactly how it happened is, you know, a question yet to be resolved.
Okay. And my last question for you may be fall into that category too, but I am curious, as I understand it, one of the sort of the holy grail of studying earthquakes is the idea of eventually getting to a place where we might be able to detect them before they actually occur. And I'm wondering, in your study, is this linkage of such that, for example, if something were to happen in Cascadia, and knowing now this linkage, might it be that it would give us some time so that phone calls could be made to San Francisco saying, oh, we're seeing this here, and it might be headed your way? Or maybe I'm obviously being too overly simplistic, but I'm just wondering if there's any benefit in this linkage towards detection.
Well, I think there is. And, you know, I've had my head down just working on the geology only, and the paper just came out. So the implications of it are, you know, yet to be thought through. But there is the possibility, and you mentioned things, you know, like early detection, or, you know, we in in geology, the prediction is the P word, and we try to never even utter that word because it's just not possible at present.
Sure.
But if we have a lot of data that shows that this linkage, this pairing or synchronization of the faults has gone on for a number of thousands of years, then you would have to say that if Cascadia had an earthquake, that the northern San Andreas, you know, could very well go within some time frame. And so it's possible that, you know, that Cascadia can serve as a natural warning for the northern San Andreas and the Bay Area. Now, the complexity of it is, you know, what if you have an indication of something that could happen? It could happen minutes from now or months from now or maybe a couple of decades from now, and you wouldn't know which, you know, it was. You know, and I don't think anyone has considered that possibility. What would you do with that information as a society? I really have no idea. But that's a secondary feature. The fact that it would act as a potential warning is a real thing, and it could potentially give much more warning time than the current automated warning systems, which give you seconds to minutes depending on, you know, your range and the type of earthquake.
Yeah, fascinating. Professor Chris Goldfinger, a marine and earthquake geologist with Oregon State University, really appreciate you coming on and talking about this fascinating subject.
Yeah, thank you for having me on, Michael.
That's the show for today. All episodes of Oregon on the Record are available as a podcast at klcc.org. Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk with a documentary film director who's put together a new movie about how indigenous people view Bigfoot, and it's strikingly different than what Western civilization has imagined and cultivated. The film just debuted at the Bend Film Festival, and it will be making the rounds throughout Oregon. I'm Michael Dunn, host of Oregon on the Record. Thanks for listening.